after Doug's keynote talk this morning telling us that we want to program our scripts in a reasonable and comprehensible manner, I'm going to completely snarl everything up by telling you what you're programming against. And I'll start by way of an example and say, suppose that we have your favorite webmail application. This happens to be a screenshot of Gmail, but I'm not picking on Gmail in specific here at all. And let's say that we manage to get an ad on the page that invitingly tells you to click there, type the following text, and win. And so you do, for whatever reason. What happens? Well, it turns out that in this case, you will mark this entire conversation as spam, right? And that's intuitively obvious, right? Because as it turns out, the keys that you type happen to have meaning to Gmail. The X key means select the entire conversation, and the exclamation mark happens to mean mark as spam. Now, you didn't intend to do that. You certainly didn't click on the spam button. So how is it that typing into that text box, into that ad region on the page, managed to trigger this behavior? Well, we could go ahead and take a look at the structure of the page. It's quite complicated. So we'll do what computer scientists do best and draw the page as a tree that looks entirely natural. So on the left, I have the sort of schematic structure of the page. And in this, I'm representing the DOM, the document object model. So we have a part of the page representing the whole thing. We have an element over here, div.conv, that represents the conversation, perhaps. We have each message, the reply box, and the ad. Okay. So what exactly is it that's being triggered when we type into this page? Well, for starters, let's say you're trying to type into the reply box. Right? So that particular element has an event listener attached to it, which is just a piece of JavaScript code that will run in response to every time you press the key. Okay? And so in this case, if you type the word hello, all of those keystrokes will filter into this event listener, and the text will be updated accordingly. Well, I mentioned earlier that Gmail has these page-wide hotkeys. So how would they go ahead and implement that? One way to do it would be to add an event listener to every single element in the page. And every single one of them would say the exact same thing. But the way that the web actually works is we've defined a different model where we can define that listener once and for all, high up in the page. And when you have an event, it will actually propagate all the way up. So let's say you click on a message and you type in those characters, it will actually go from that message to each of its ancestors all the way up, seeing if there's an event listener that's interested in the event. Okay, and so in this case, if you type a character, it propagates up. So what happens when you click on the ad is you focus that element. And so keystrokes are going to be sent to that element first. And what it's going to do is it's going to cancel almost all of them, except for the ones that it chooses to let through. Okay, so it can filter a bunch of these events. It will again propagate up from the ad to the page, and as a result, you'll trigger this behavior. This is not particularly intuitive. This is certainly not intended, and it requires pretty careful coding on the part of Gmail to defend itself against these unanticipated events. Right? Defensive coding should be standard, but it's fail open. If you make a mistake anywhere, you're kind of hosed. So in this case, as I said, if you type in the word that it suggests, it will filter everything and just let through the commands. Okay, so to sort of summarize that example in a nutshell, if we actually want to understand what's going on inside a web application, we must understand not only the JavaScript, but the event model of the page that it's running against. So how are we going to understand that event model? Well, I've introduced a bunch of terms, and I want to just summarize the various subtleties that have already cropped up just in this fairly simple example. We have events. We have event listeners. Events get sent to approximate target. You can cancel events. You can bubble them up from the target to its ancestors. This is the dispatch path, okay? And for symmetry, there's also a downwards path from the root of the page down to an element called capturing. We'll gloss over that for this talk, but we handle that as well, okay? So already, this is a fairly sophisticated event dispatch model. And if you're familiar with more traditional event-based programming models like .NET or Java's UI or almost any other model, you might be wondering why all the complexity, right? And primarily, it's to do with the fact that web pages have this nice tree structure, and we want to be able to exploit that structure in some fashion. But this is JavaScript, and it is dynamic, and the page is dynamic, and so there are a whole bunch of problems between this. And these tend to arise with various mutations that the script can perform, either with the set of listeners that are installed or with the structure of the page itself. So for example, we can have multiple listeners for any given event type on any given node. And we can add and remove them dynamically over the course of the page. So what order should those event listeners run in? If we have tree mutation where during the course of dispatch, let's say we're at the target node, and during dispatch we detach that node and move it elsewhere in the tree, does the dispatch path stay the same? Does it change to reflect the new reality? If we go ahead and add and remove listeners themselves during the dispatch, do the new ones get to fire? Do the old ones still fire? It turns out it depends. There's also this other legacy notion of handlers, which is a less flexible form of listeners, and how those interact with the control flow of listeners is yet another annoyance. And then finally, there's this notion of default actions. When you actually click on a link in a browser, it will do something on your behalf. Usually, it will navigate the page. If you click on a button, it will do something on your behalf, right? If you type into a text box. And so then you might wonder, well, can you cancel this default behavior and substitute your own? And sometimes you can and sometimes you can't, and the details about this are likewise tricky. So based on just the straightforward model that we have before, we now have to account for all of these details as well. If you've programmed with web content before, you actually have a fairly rich model of what the dispatch algorithm is really doing. When an event fires, we're going to start by building up the dispatch path. Once we know what the dispatch path is, we can start sending the event to everything along that path. So what we'll do is we'll start at the first node on the path, we'll collect all of the listeners, and then we'll run them. And that involves actually running JavaScript until it finishes. If it finishes, when it finishes, we come back and we say, are there more listeners on this node? If so, we repeat, run the next listener. And we do that until we've run out of listeners on this node, and then we say, okay, is there another node in the dispatch path? And if there is, we start the whole process over again. And eventually, when we're finally done with the last listener on the last node of the dispatch path, we move off to the default handling behavior. Okay? Now there's a bunch of other transitions that I haven't mentioned in here for how you cancel dispatch and how you prevent further listeners from running and so on, but this is complicated enough as it is. This picture exists nowhere in the spec for how events actually work. It's defined in terms of text. So you might be wondering, you know, is this in fact specified? And yes, it is. It's a long specification. It is a complicated specification. And the core details of it are about 16 pages that explain exactly how this dispatch mechanism works. And those 16 pages are not entirely self-contained because they call out to other specifications to explain what they do. And it's not even self-consistent. So for example, this is a short excerpt from the documentation for one method of event dispatch. This particular text has been there since 2009. I'm sure we can all see that it's inconsistent, figure out the resolution and move on, right? The problem here is, in fact, that the summary of the method and the summary of the meaning of one of the parameters to this method are mutually inconsistent. Okay? Browsers seem to have standardized on ignoring the summary at the top using just the description of the parameter, but if you were implementing this for the first time, you wouldn't know necessarily which one to pick. Okay, and this is the spec. This is our ground truth for what the browser is supposed to be doing. So what can we do? Well, what we've done is we've built a formal model of the event dispatch mechanism in Redex. And it's about 1,000 lines of commented code. So it's tractable. You can actually read it. It's analyzable. It's formal, right? We can actually run standard programming languages tools over this model. It's executable. What Redex lets you do is when you write down a semantics, you can run it. And you can actually see what it does on various inputs. You can generate random tests and basically fuzz test the model. And finally, it's composable. We can combine this model with other models that we have for further precision. So first, a note about what Redex is. Redex is a framework. It's designed in PLT Racket, or Scheme, that's designed for language engineering. It makes it really easy to write down the syntax of your language and the semantics of the evaluation rules of your language, and then you can run those semantics and actually test it. Okay? And this is particularly convenient for web specs because the way that modern web specs are being written is already fairly idiomatic step-by-step-by-step instructions on what the browser is supposed to be doing. And so we can actually encode those idioms fairly naturally into Redex. And this is what we've done. So for example, that page of spec text that I showed you a couple slides ago boils down to this in our model. It says, when you want to add a listener, we have various things that we need. We need to know the event type, whether it's using capture, what you're actually doing, and then it tells you exactly what it's going to do. And the advantage here is that there's no room for ambiguity. This is a program. It will have one meaning. Right? And so the ambiguity about what to do with the capture term simply doesn't arise. Okay? So what can we actually use this model for? Well, there's a whole bunch of things that people just know about event dispatch that web developers just know and rely upon when they're writing their web applications. So for example, when you modify the tree, it won't impact the dispatch path of the current event. And if you're going to dispatch an event and you don't cancel it, then every node on that dispatch will be visited twice, once descending into the tree and once ascending back out. Or that dispatch is deterministic or that it ultimately should terminate, right? And this is all basically folklore knowledge and it's certainly intended to hold of the spec, but in our case, there are actually theorems that we can prove about our model. Right, so we formally know that these things are facts. So for example, how do we know that modifying the tree doesn't impact dispatch? Well, we look at the dispatch rules. Right, this is what our model says. And we see that there is one state in our model where we actually modify the path. And then once we move on to actually running the listeners, that path is fixed because you just look at the rules. And it's equal on both sides of the rules, end of story, right? It's almost a trivial theorem to prove, which is good. We want it to be trivial because we want this common knowledge to hold. But then that sort of begs the question, how do we know that this actually resembles the spec, right? The spec is this fairly complicated piece of text. This is a relatively smaller self-contained piece of code. How do we know that they match up? And so what we've done as we've actually annotated a copy of the spec and a copy of our model with comments that basically cross-link corresponding bits of the model to the spec text that they are intended to correlate with. Okay, so if you are a fairly well-informed reader, you can read our model, you can read the spec, you can literally just align pieces and assure yourself that each piece matches up. Right? Now, we can't actually formally prove that our model matches the spec because, well, the spec is informal. If you could formally prove anything about the spec, we wouldn't need the model. Right? So this is pretty much as close as we can get to strong assurance. So what else can we actually do with the model? I mentioned that Redex is executable. Right? You can actually run models, you can generate inputs, and you can see what the model does. So for example, we can automatically construct all of the tiny trees that contain up to 5 nodes and up to 4 listeners, and they can do sort of whatever. And then we can run those models through our system, dispatch an event into it, and see what we get as our predicted output. Right? We can also basically pretty print the model into actual HTML and JavaScript. And now we can run that in browsers. And we can compare the outputs between what our simulation predicts and what browsers actually do. And to anybody who's dealt with web compat issues before, it should come as no surprise that we can find small models here where not only does our model disagree with the browsers, but they disagree with each other. Okay? Now, the flip side, of course, is that we can then modify our model to figure out exactly where it is that individual browsers are going wrong. And we can say, aha, they appear to be doing this one step of the spec incorrectly. So another example, the one that actually got me excited about this in the first place, how many people have actually looked at the engineering behind either Thunderbird or Firefox or other Mozilla products? Okay. So if you're not familiar with them, it turns out that the entire UI of Firefox and the entire UI of Thunderbird is itself effectively a web page. It's not HTML, it's a dialect of XML, but essentially it is a page, it has its own document object model, it has its own event listeners, and so on. And as a result, this has enabled a fairly pervasive and powerful extension mechanism for these things that allow you to customize the UI in various ways. So for example, we have one extension for Thunderbird called Nostalgie that gives you sort of hotkey access to either jumping to folders or saving the current message to them or copying to additional folders. So in this case, I press the letter G, and then I get this text box down at the bottom where I can type in the folder name that I want to go to, press enter, and we're good. Okay? We can also have another extension called Thunderbird Conversations. This is a very popular extension for Thunderbird that actually gives you a sort of Gmail-like conversation view within the Thunderbird UI, complete with a quick reply box and a quick reply all box. So you click in that box and you start typing, and then you press send, and hopefully it gets sent. So what can go wrong? Any ideas? Well, what happens if I start typing a word that has the letter S in it? And then I type in something that happens to be equal to a folder name and press enter. You'd expect that it goes into the email that you're composing. But just like the Gmail example where we have sort of these global hotkeys, S is now a global hotkey. And in fact, when you start typing into this text box, S triggers that the folder selection UI at the bottom, it steals focus, you start typing there, you press enter, and you jump to a new folder instead of continuing to write your message. So this is clearly odd. This is clearly not the behavior that we expect. But the question is, how would you have predicted this? And once you've predicted it, how would you fix it? Right? Now, if you stare at this for a little while, you say, oh, of course, this event should not have propagated outwards. Right? We should have just canceled the event in the first place. How do you know which event to cancel? It turns out it's not just key down. It could be key press or key up. The model is fairly sophisticated. And as it turns out, what we actually did was predict a particular fix. We took Thunderbird's UI, imported it into our model, predicted a fix, tested it. Our model predicted that it should work. We implemented the fix in the extension. Didn't work. Why is that? Because it turns out that the event dispatch mechanism in Gecko doesn't quite obey the spec. Okay, and so we reported this as a bug to the Nostalgie and Conversations authors. They fixed their code accordingly. Right? We reported it to Mozilla. It hasn't been fixed yet, but we'll see. Okay, further uses of the model. So far, I've only been talking about how events get dispatched. Doug was talking about how JavaScript works and how you want to write it to be cleaner. Redex has a particularly clean way of composing models of languages. So in our particular model, we have a toy implementation of JavaScript. It's not the full JavaScript syntax and the full JavaScript semantics. It's add event listener, do thing, cancel. right? It's the most stripped down API we need to interact with the event model. But we actually have a Redex model of JavaScript. Other work that was done at Brown with Joe Politz and Arjun Guha produced something called LambdaJS, which is a tiny kernel of JavaScript to which they can basically compile all the rest of JavaScript. And that is a nice, simple, composable Redex model. And we can basically plug their language in for our toy JavaScript language, and now we'll have a composite model of JavaScript and events. You can build a further model of the DOM and be more precise about what the structure of the page is. You'll then have a composite model of events, JavaScript, and the structure of the page. Right? And so all of this is basically building up towards where we can actually build a tractable model of web browser behavior. I haven't talked about network, I haven't talked about storage, I haven't talked about a whole bunch of other pieces of the browser, but you can see how the pattern would basically continue itself. And the model that we've produced here, where we have a model, it's testable, you can compare outputs, scales well to all of these composite pieces. Okay? So to sum up, the contributions of this work are a tractable and formal model for dispatch. It's small, it's readable, it's analyzable, it's testable, it's executable, and it's composable. And we hope that if any of you are doing formal verification work on web apps, or if you're interested in trying to better test your applications, that you might be interested in using this in your own work. And with that, I'd like to take questions.
So we have a lot of time for questions. Next week we need to set up.
Howdy. James Mickens, Microsoft Research. Cool stuff. So one question I have is towards the end of your talk, you were mentioning some extensions you could do, add modeling for JavaScript and other things. And so I'm wondering if, I mean, browsers are so complicated that I wonder that if you were to do that, to make that full browser model, that essentially you'd have something that doesn't capture all of the interesting sort of interactions from these components that actually give rise to a lot of these quote-unquote emergent quirks.
Yep.
And so perhaps, do you think maybe a more useful direction is to actually try to make maybe a verifiable browser end-to-end, in the same way that some people have looked at, you know, verifiable operating system kernels or things like that?
Yep. So I think they are complementary lines of research. And I think having a verifiable browser kernel is a laudable goal, a complicated goal, one that I'm working on myself, that I'm interested in pursuing. But I think that in this case, one of the things that Redex will let you do, right? So let's say you wanted to prove that your composite model is still deterministic, right? It will say no. It will say, I can evaluate this thing, and it turns out I get multiple outputs. You say, oh, I must have missed some restriction in my model that's one of these emergent properties for how they interact. So one of the things that Redex as a substrate for doing this kind of modeling is really good for is picking out those missing cases and seeing where the emergent behaviors are. Because it is never the case, we would love it to be the case, that you know the composition of two languages is simply their union. It never is, right? But this thing will let you see what else there needs to be.
Cool, thanks.
Hi, I was wondering, when you talked about, in the beginning of your talk, you said here's a part of the spec and the summary is in disagreement with part of the parameter definitions. So what are you modeling? When you have that internal contradiction, what do you do for your model?
So in this case, we sort of voted among the other browsers, right? And we matched what they do. So in this case, we took the description of the parameter as opposed to the spec.
Okay, so
but
it's...
there has to be some judgment because, as I said, the model is formal. The spec is English, right?
And the browsers do different things.
And the browsers do different things, sure. And so it turns out the inconsistencies between browsers that we found has to deal with what they do with legacy handlers versus current listeners and their execution orders, very fiddly stuff. Mm-hmm. In this particular instance, the browsers are in unanimous agreement and the spec is simply not.
Okay.
Right? But you could then go ahead and say, I have this annotated spec, I have the annotated model, I look at them and say, wait, that doesn't quite match. Which of these meanings did I intend? right? And so merely by claiming that we have a correspondence helps highlight where these inconsistencies might be.
And have the people who own the spec, what's your communication with them as far as
they haven't responded to me yet.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I'm on the mailing lists and sent messages there.
Still have a few more minutes.
One question. Are you thinking of doing kind of like online maybe a tool where people could submit their apps and then you would try to help them build a model or
I think
sort
that's
of JSLint, but...
Yeah. I think that's a useful tool. It won't be usable until after we've merged it with LambdaJS. Because at the moment, what we've done is we've extracted the tree structure of the page, and we've then manually translated the event listeners into our miniature expression language. If we had actual LambdaJS, we could translate them directly, and then we could execute over the LambdaJS model. So there's some more engineering work before we could make that tool feasible. Once we do, there are ways to expose Redex models through the web. There are other projects going on at Brown that do that. So yeah, we could imagine providing a DOM event lint like tool. All
right. DOM lint. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks very much.